We would like to take a moment to thank our sponsor, Preborn. When a mother meets her baby on an ultrasound and hears their heartbeat, it's a divine connection, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. But she can't do it without our help. Preborn needs us, the pro-life community, to come alongside her. One ultrasound is just $28. To donate, dial #250 and say the keyword baby, or visit preborn.com.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Well, we have for the last few weeks, and this has now been a month of the Trump administration, we've talked about the headlines and the progress that has been made of dismantling the administrative state, the work that DOGE has been doing to actually infect DC with sunlight and maybe disinfect them with accountability of all of this ridiculous, reckless spending. We've seen Trump's executive orders. Most of them have been fantastic, phenomenal. And also to hopefully reduce all of the spending and maybe even stop income tax and perhaps dismantle the IRS. I mean, wouldn't that be amazing? We've also talked about, you know, some of the broader policy implications of that. How could this go? If you missed last Friday, my conversation with Paul Teller on Demand on our AFR exclusive podcast, we did a deep dive into some of the ways that the policy elements should be shaped. So all of this, and I also did an entire show on dismantling the administrative state from a biblical worldview perspective and why the biblical principles of self-government as the best context to exercise liberty and freedom is what our founders originally envisioned. And we didn't just kind of mythically rise out of the mist as America. We actually had founders who understood all of these principles of anthropology, theology, and also civil government, and devised a structure of our constitutional republic that aimed to achieve that goal. And we've gotten so far off track of that, that's what I want this conversation to focus on for the next two segments. Really, where are we at with kind of the original intent of the Constitution, and perhaps a return to conserving that whole idea of our founders in fostering and promoting and protecting, ultimately, liberty. So joining me for this conversation is our good friend Mike Donnelly, who is a constitutional law professor, who's also an attorney and is one of the best pontificators on this topic. So Mike, I really appreciate you joining. We've had a lot of discussions over the years about the Constitution, how to perhaps amend the amendments, how to fix some of the broken, you know, processes of things, how we've gotten so far off track. So that is a wildly broad topic. I will admit that fully. But in terms of where we are situated in 2025, how do we best conserve the original intent?
Well, Jen, it's always great to be with you and to talk with your listeners. You must have some of the most interesting listeners in your audience because you're talking about such interesting things. And I guess I am a pontificator. People can see my very short pontificators on X, on which I pontificate way too much. If they want to go to @DonnellySpeaks, and I'm pontificating on X. Usually,
aren't all lawyers
short.
Professional pontificators, though? Like, we say we file briefs, but nothing is ever brief anyway. So, I mean, I think that's okay.
A legal brief is an oxymoron.
Absolutely.
But to your question, you know, I think this is maybe the second time we've talked since the inauguration, but man, when I look in the rearview mirror at the last 30 days, it seems like it's been a year. And I've been saying that Donald Trump has gotten more done in a month than Joe Biden got done in 4 years. And he's turned things around way more quickly than I could have imagined. And I've been incredibly impressed You know, how did we get here? Where are we going? I mean, the things that we're talking about, that he's talking about, that members of his cabinet are talking about, over and above the actions that he is taking and that he's got Elon Musk and the Doge guys taking, I think is very exciting, because we're talking about things that I've been thinking about for at least two decades as I kind of despaired about our country, our republic, because of how big the federal government had become, how it had crowded out the states, how it was the biggest threat to our liberty because of its massive influence and involvement in our lives, how it was directing so much of our country. And when you think about the size of the federal government over the last 100 years, just as an example, as a percentage of GDP, the federal government has grown from 1.5% of GDP to nearly 25% of GDP. And if you use that as a measuring stick about the power, the influence, the extent of the federal government, it's stunning. And when you compare it to what the founders intended, it's words escape me. I can't even think of a word to describe how the how it would compare. It doesn't compare. It's completely antithetical to what the founders intended for the federal government to be. Now, the federal to be sure, let's be clear, the founders wanted a strong executive branch in the federal government. They wanted a stronger federal government because they were frustrated with the Articles of Confederation, which had been framed in 1777, 1778, and through the Revolutionary period, the War for Independence, as I prefer to call it. And it was a kind of a consensus. It was rule by consensus. It was rule by committee. Every state had to agree. If they didn't, one could block. And it was challenging for the country to operate as a country. And so, you know, the founders got together and said, we got to think of something different. So they came up with the Constitution. And as they debated the separation of powers and the structure of the Constitution, they were very mindful of putting in guardrails, and they were mindful of they didn't want another king, but they still wanted a stronger executive. And when you look at what the president is doing, a lot of it is around the executive branch, as it should be. He's the chief executive. And that's one of the issues that I think where we've gotten a little bit off course, and where I think he's, you know, using the authority of the executive branch to move us back in a better direction. But people can argue, you know, should that be what the executive branch is doing? The executive branch has become this very powerful thing. Was it supposed to be that powerful? I would say no. But it's been doing so many bad things for Trump to come in and then, you know, turn it around and do good things. Okay, that's good. But still, I think we could have a conversation as a country. Do we want the president, you know, to have so much power? I would say no. We have too many cabinets. We have too many functions at the federal government level. You know, so I'm excited about the fact that we're having this conversation about the size of the federal government. It's too big. We're cutting it back, which, by the way, not the first time we've done this, right? I mean, people may be familiar with the conversations that are being had around Clinton. Even Obama talked about cutting the government back in the Clinton era. They, you know, they had similar buyouts that Trump has done or is doing. You know, they tried to reduce the federal workforce by several hundred thousand back even during Clinton's time. So this is not new. But when we start talking about things that are structural, that's what really gets me going. That gets me excited when I hear Donald Trump or you know, his new Commerce Secretary Lutkin talk about abolishing the IRS, for example. And to do that, I believe you'd have to repeal the 16th Amendment, which is what allowed for the income tax to begin with, which it was an amendment to the Constitution, which means that framers did not intend for us to have an income tax. And it was our citizens, our fellow citizens, who did that to us 110 years ago. Probably one of the biggest mistakes I think our citizens have ever made. So I'll stop for a second, and why don't you direct the conversation where you want it to go.
Absolutely. Well, no, I think that was a brilliant opening statement, counsel, and you know, and pontification, if I might add. But I think you're absolutely right.
Guilty as charged. Guilty as charged.
Yeah. See, this is why he's a professional pontificator. But, you know, but it's great because this is why I love radio, because we have the time to actually go more in detail, not just, you know, the 30 seconds that that some of the legacy media gives for you to explain the Constitution, you know. So so with all of this and kind of this history and background, I mean, there is some conversation to say, well, you know, some of these things on the federal level, because of the technology growth, the, you know, the new era we're in, I mean, for whatever reason they want to blame it on, they say some of these federal agencies maybe weren't contemplated by the founders, but now are needed. Where my argument to that is, so, well, why, and which ones, and why can't we have a leaner, meaner federal government that is only doing and exercising, only doing the capacity and exercising the powers that the Constitution originally provided? I mean, things like a uniform rule of immigration and naturalization. I mean, that makes sense that it has to be on the federal level, because we don't want California having a different rule than Texas, right? Because it affects all of us. But when we're dealing with things that should be local and for the people and the different laboratories of democracy, as the states are called, we don't need the federal government to dictate and particularly have strings attached with money to the states, nor then do we need the 16th Amendment and this just outrageous level of income tax for the people to then go and spend on all of these just utterly ridiculous, preposterous things that aren't even benefiting the American people. I mean, there's literally no argument for it, some of the stuff that Doge has uncovered. So I think all of this is just going to show that maybe, just maybe, the original intent is actually the best design. But as you mentioned, Mike, it probably would take a repeal of the 16th Amendment to actually get rid of income tax as a whole. But Donald Trump has said, even this week, you know, he's firing 6,000 IRS agents. There's more that have, you know, been reassigned elsewhere and doing other things. What can practically be done by the Trump administration on income tax and trying to curb this whole theft from the American people while the 16th Amendment remains in place?
Well, that's an excellent question, and I'm not a tax expert, but I think when we talk about the income tax, I just want to explore the idea of why it's such a problem. You know, and people may get this inherently, but let's just tease it out very briefly, right? Let's give the government the authority to decide when and how much of our money they want to take. Then let's let Congress pass laws and the Supreme Court say, sure, you can solve any problem you want to and take as much money as you want from the American people to do so. That's not a recipe for disaster, is it? But that's what we've been living for the last 100 and some years. And so when you talk about, you know, what can the Trump administration do about the IRS, I'm not sure that they can do a whole lot other than what they're doing right now and try to restrain and lobby Congress. Because the Internal Revenue Code is a creature of Congress. So Congress is the one who's going to have to take action, which, you know.
Good luck.
President Trump can do a lot. Yeah, exactly. President Trump can do a lot, which is great. He's doing a lot of good things, in my opinion. Congress has done a lot of bad things over a really long period of time, and it's a very razor-thin majority right now in the Republicans. And Republicans are not unified on wanting to reform government in the way that you and I think, believe it should be reformed. And so abolishing the income tax, I mean, there are so many members of Congress who would just not even want to have that conversation. It's very disappointing. But that's why I love that, you know, Trump is at least talking about it, because as the popular president with a lot of authority in the executive branch and with members of Congress realizing that if Trump comes after them, that's a problem, they have an incentive to want to at least talk nicely about such things. And so if at least we can start talking about it, you know, if people can start imagining it, then maybe it can happen. Because when you, if you don't talk about it, you're never going to do anything about it, right? And this idea of repealing the income tax is not a new one. You know, there's been a movement to repeal the income tax for a long time. But there is a very serious proposal called the Fair Tax that's been around as a formal organization and movement for almost 30 years. people can look it up. It's called the Fair Tax. I'm a big supporter of it. It repeals the 16th Amendment, gets rid of the IRS and the Internal Revenue Code, and implements a national sales tax. And, you know, when you talk about tariffs, and tariffs is just a tax. It's basically a tax on goods coming into your country from other countries. But it's like a sales tax. And that's a consumption-based tax, which inherently, in my opinion, is a lot fairer and appropriate and in line with what the founders intended for us to use as a way to fund government than an income tax. Because think about it. When the government's taxing your income, what are they really taking away from you? They're really taking away from you your liberty. Because what do you have that's only yours other than your body, right? Yeah, we could argue about that. But 24 hours a day, and what you choose to do with those hours should be yours and yours alone. But when the government taxes your income and your labor, they're saying, oh, no. You work for us until you pay off the debt of your income tax. And the reality is it takes 3 to 5 months for any average person to pay their income taxes. That's a problem. I call that economic slavery. And that's why I believe that the Internal Revenue Code is very problematic, and why we have to do something about it.
That is a really brilliant description. I was speaking with Mike Donnelly, who is a constitutional law professor and an attorney. And I think anyone who is familiar with paying taxes, which is anybody who's not just dependent on government handouts, is really frustrated with how high the rate of federal income taxes. I mean, there are some states, including now my home state of Florida, that doesn't have an income tax, and I save a lot compared to when I was paying taxes to the state of Colorado when I was a resident there. And even just that much relief is a good thing. We still have sales tax. A lot of the budget here is based on tourism because so many people come to Florida. And so, you know, it's kind of the same principle on a state level as a tariff or a sales tax would be on a national level. And Florida's doing just fine. We actually have a budget surplus because of Governor DeSantis and the way that we have been principled as a state. And we could do that same thing on the federal level. But I don't really see the Congress on both sides, especially with what's come out with even Republicans that have had a lot of these this USAID, you know, funding organizations that maybe they're part of or they're on the boards of that are in the excess of, you know, millions and millions of dollars. I don't see Congress really having an incentive to balance the budget or to have this this kind of economic conservative principle and ethos. And so is it going to take something from the executive branch, but maybe even the states to then say, you know, we really need to take this out of Congress's hands? And is there a mechanism for that?
Yeah, there is. And when you talk about it, again, I think we as a nation need to have a conversation about how we solve problems. And at what level we solve problems. Because right now the federal government is solving way too many quote-unquote problems. And I'm talking about the welfare state. Because the welfare state, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, are over half of the money that comes from the federal government. Some of it, like Medicaid, is a state program where the federal government comes in and tells you, we'll give you this money if you dance to our tune, you know, the strings attached. Medicare is a national health program. Social Security is Social Security. People know what that is. You know, those are very big problems. Half of the population in the United States depend on those sources of income and support for health. So how are we going to solve those problems? Should we solve them at the federal level or at the state level?
We're up against a hard break, and so let's answer that question when we come right back with more here with Mike Donnelly talking about restoring the American way of government and our initial founding and actually having government work on behalf of America. So we'll be right back with more.
Speaking truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the morning.
Welcome back. We are talking about restoring the original intent of the U.S. Constitution and economic principles of freedom and liberty and moral principles, by the way, of freedom and liberty with my special guest, Mike Donnelly, who is a constitutional law professor and an attorney and also a very dear friend. He is really prolific in this area, and we are very grateful to benefit from his wisdom on this. And before the break, Mike, we were talking about, you know, whether we should have some of these solutions on the federal level or the state level, and what is the best mechanism that the founders provided to address solutions like perhaps balancing the budget and not taking so much of the property and basically theft from the American people.
Yeah, Jenna. And, you know, again, putting it on the table here, we talked about, you know, the size of the welfare state before and where problems are being solved and what can be done to restore the balance of power. And, you know, the founders gave us Article 5 in the Constitution as a way for the states or the people through their elected representatives, because there's two ways that you can amend the Constitution if you feel like you need to in order to impose restraint or rules on the federal government. Because remember, the Constitution of the United States of America is a document that empowers and restrains the federal government, and it divides the sovereign power among the federal government and among the sovereign states, who are also sovereign entities, right? So this is a republic. We're not a democracy. And so Article 5 says, you know, look, Congress can amend the Constitution, and it's proposed. Most of the amendments that have come to the Constitution have been proposed by Congress. They haven't done it in a long time. There's some they've proposed but haven't been ratified. And then the other mechanism is by the states calling a constitutional convention. And there are a number of different efforts underway to do that. Some people are afraid of that. Some people have concerns about it. I understand those concerns. But, you know, to me, I think about it this way. What's the definition of insanity? Keep doing the same thing and expect different results. You know, people think, oh, we can just put better people into Washington, D.C. in the chairs there, and those people will then do something different. And you talked before about whether they had an incentive or not. Well, when you talk about chairs and putting good people in Washington, I think you're just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic, because the incentives are not there for them to do something. So I do think that the states have the authority, they have power, and they need to exercise it. And, you know, a couple of examples. One is, there's a balanced budget amendment that is making its way around the states. I think 29 or 30 states have ratified a call to impose a balanced budget amendment on Congress. There is a term limits. There are a number of these ones. Term limits, I think, has 9 states that have called for a constitutional convention to amend the Constitution on term limits. But there's also a broader call to impose more limits on the federal government, both on the judicial branch, on the executive, as well as on the Congress, and fiscally, under the Convention of States Project, which is also achieved. I don't know, maybe it's 20 states who are supporting that. So there's some momentum for the states to sort of stand up and say, hey, federal government, we're if you don't do something to rein yourself in, we're going to do it. These things take time. These are not easy solutions. We're a big country. There's a lot of competing interests. But I'm excited by the fact that I see, one, Donald Trump talking about these issues. I see the states stepping up and saying, hey, you know what? People like Ron DeSantis saying, hey, we're not going to put up with this anymore. We're going to do something about it. Or state legislatures, you know, approving these calls for a constitutional convention. I think we've got to try new, creative, innovative ways to solve these really tough problems, or we're lost as a country.
Yeah, and you and I have been advocates very enthusiastically of Convention of States for years now. And there are, you know, of course, some concerns. And every time we bring up this topic on air, I always get, you know, some emails from listeners saying, well, you know, what about this? What about that? You know, all those things. And there are definitely valid questions. There are valid concerns. And all of those things have been addressed previously by articles from, you know, kind of founding members of the Convention of States Project, like Mark Meckler, like Michael Ferris, who used to be the CEO of Alliance Defending Freedom. You know, some of these really in-depth experts on Article 5, and there are responses to this. And so, you know, for skeptics, I would say, you know, before you approach this with kind of the knee-jerk reaction of, you know, oh, we can't call a convention because then, you know, our entire Constitution is going to be overhauled. Well, no, that's not precisely accurate. And you definitely want to read the materials on this and understand what Article 5 is actually proposing, how the process would work. before you just have kind of this, no, that's not the solution. Because this is what the founders envisioned and what they actually textually provided for. And when they created the Constitution and ratified it in its original form, they're not going to put a poison pill in there that's literally, you know, this is how we can amend the Constitution if they were not satisfied with the ultimate product. And you can go back to the history and the debate at the Constitutional Convention to see why Article 5 was written in the way that it was and why the power was given to the states to also propose amendments, not just to the Congress. And so for people, Mike, who are saying, Constitutional Convention, this will overhaul everything. Well, the Congress has proposed amendments that have been ratified 27 times in our nation's history, and we still have the Constitution. And arguably, without the provision of allowing the states and the states not utilizing that provision, that's why we've gotten so far off track with all of these ridiculous extra constitutional or even anti-constitutional opinions from the Supreme Court and the rise of the administrative state and bureaucracy.
Well, I couldn't agree more, Jenna, although I will say to those who are skeptical about a constitutional convention, I understand, and I don't think they're wrong to be skeptical. I taught constitutional law at Patrick Henry College. Patrick Henry led the charge to reject the Constitution in the Virginia House of Burgesses. Okay? Why? Because he was afraid of exactly what is happening today in our country. Now, I think the Constitution is great. I think it it's been ignored. The Supreme Court has not imposed constitutional constraints. It's allowed Congress to get away with things that it shouldn't have. It's allowed the executive branch to get away with things it shouldn't have. Congress has done what all human institutions do: seek more power, seek less accountability, and get bigger. Right? I mean, that's what, that's the sin nature, right? And the founders recognized that, and they tried to put in guardrails, and they did. But you know what? We human beings are going to find a way around those guardrails if we can. And so when it's like, use that analogy, extend it. When you break down a guardrail, you put up another one, and you try to put it in the same place. But that's not what happened. Congress broke through the guardrails, and the courts either didn't put up a new one, or they put it up, a little bit further down. And so Congress kept expanding, and the executive branch expanding, and the whole federal government allowed itself to expand. You know, I've always had this idea. I think of, when the states try to go up against any branch of the federal government will defend itself, all the branches, against any state incursion. But then when you've got intra-branch disputes among the federal government branches, they all want more power. The Supreme Court, Congress, and the executive branch altogether, right? Again, it's human nature. So I'm sensitive to, the skepticism. But as you pointed out very wisely, this is part of the reason why we are in this situation, because we haven't put up the guardrails, had constitutional conventions. Congress doesn't want to change things. That's why they haven't been proposing amendments that would actually solve these problems. They like the power. They don't want the accountability, and it's hard work. So we the people, if we want to continue to be we the people, are going to have to do it. And we have to do it through our state legislatures, because the states are sovereign entities. And I'm encouraged. I see a lot of state legislatures, and I know a bunch of state legislators around the country. And I think they are aware of this. They're busy because they're trying to run their state and make sure that they get their state in a good situation. But they are very concerned about what's happening with the country and the federal government. And that's why you see states doing things like establishing their own Bitcoin reserve, talking about setting up their own state banks, because they're afraid that the federal government is not going to fix itself, and that could be catastrophic. And so they're saying, you know what? We got to do something to protect our constituents, our citizens, from that problem. So yeah. Getting back to the Article 5 convention, though, I think I'm sensitive to people's skepticism. But listen, when the founders had the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, you didn't have the internet, you didn't have Facebook, you didn't have iPhones. You can't keep anything secret. They have their thing secret, but you can't keep anything secret anymore. We've got technology and communications that, the problems that people are afraid of happening, that, you could say maybe it kind of happened a little bit. They were secret then and people didn't know what was going on. And there really was no way for people to know. We live in a completely different time. And I think that's to our benefit. And I think it can answer some of those concerns that people have.
Yeah, absolutely well said. And I think that if we are only championing the executive orders coming out from Donald Trump and even, you know, this kind of revolutionary sort of agency of DOGE and saying that we're championing everything that they're doing, but then we're, on the other hand, skeptical or even outright opposing solutions that the founders provided that we haven't taken advantage of, we're missing a huge opportunity to actually complete the work of America First. And that's where I have a huge advocacy base for the Convention of States to say, you know, this can't just be from the executive. It should be government as a whole firing on all cylinders, and it should be the Congress that is keeping the federal government in check, the balanced budget, not taking advantage of the American people. It should be the executive in the faithful constitution execution of laws. And it should be the judiciary keeping the two political branches confined to their specific limited powers. Now, that's an ideal world, right? But of course, as Madison very wisely recognized in the Federalist Papers and, you know, why the founders wanted power contradicting powers, because they recognized that people in power will want to continue to grow their own power. And unfortunately, the federal government and the uniparty in D.C. has wanted to work together and not just in a conspiracy, but literally just openly saying we want the federal government to grow. I don't think the federal government overall is going to get fixed with even as much as DOGE and the executive orders and perhaps even this new composition of the current Supreme Court for an enduring legacy for America that's beyond just the next few years and truly rooting out the big bureaucracy of the administrative state. Because it's not just about the deep state. It's about all of the power and the money that is going to it without the people and the states getting involved. And that's what Article 5 provides. And so if we're going back to the original intent of the Constitution, Mike Donnelly, originally we have Article 5. And I think that that provision has been so woefully ignored over the rise of the of the administrative state for the last 100 years that it's just sat as a dormant clause that nobody has really taken advantage of. And that's truly a shame. And so if we're going to get back to the original intent of the Constitution, the original intent of federalism, I don't see how we can do that absent, with everything else going on, but absent actually also having a convention of the states.
Well, Jenna, you're right. And ultimately, we have to look in the mirror as the American people. We get the government we deserve. And if we want things to change, we've got to do something about it. The founders gave us the mechanism. It's in the Constitution. Some people are trying to do something about it, but it's hard. It is really hard. In a big country with 50 states, you've got to get 34 states to ratify. It's difficult. So my hat is off to those who are trying to do that. But my encouragement to people who are listening here to us today is do something. Get involved. Talk to your local legislator, your state delegate, your state senator. Find out who that is. If you don't know who that is, you should know. You should have their cell phone number. You should be talking to them. You should be asking them these questions like, hey, what are you going to do about this problem? Because we, this people, through the states, are the only ones who are going to fix this. And really, I think through Article 5, because it's a structural problem we're dealing with. What Trump and Elon are doing, which are great, by the way, I love it. They're just barely scratching the surface. $100 billion in savings? That's nothing. That's nothing, my friends. We are $36 trillion in debt. I mean, can you even imagine what that is? That is an existential threat to our country, to our kids, to our grandkids, to future generations. We took a step back from the very edge of a crumbling cliff when we elected Donald Trump and he brought in Elon Musk. We are nowhere near safe territory. Stable ground for the Republic. So, you know, don't get complacent. Don't be overconfident. Yes, let's be thankful and grateful for the work that's being done, but let's not kid ourselves that it's the long-term solution. This is a massive problem we're facing. It is not going to be solved by Donald Trump and Elon Musk. Congress has to be involved. We've got a breathing space here. Let's use it.
Absolutely. And that is wise advice, that for as much as we on the conservative side, you know, believe ourselves, I think rightly, to be patriots, to be passionate about America and civics and our country and its direction and the morality and future generations, all of these things, we have to do more than just complain. We have to do more than just talk about it. We have to be participants in solutions. And this is why voting matters, why primaries matter, why being informed citizens matter. And this is why, though, even separate and apart from voting, we have to be engaged on a day-to-day basis of knowing what's going on in our state, what's going on at the federal level, being involved in those things. Even if you can't, you know, run for office, that's not everybody's calling, certainly. I mean, it's not mine. And so, but I'm engaged in a lot of other ways. We have to be engaged in this, and we have to promote solutions that are the best tailored to actually fulfill the mission. And the mission, of course, is preserving and protecting the rights that come from God, our Creator. That is the sole legitimate purpose of any government, and certainly America's, that was founded recognizing that eternal truth. So, Mike Donnelly, we are already out of time here, but I so appreciate your analysis. You can follow him on X. I'd encourage you to do that. For all his pontification, at Donnelly Speaks. And we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning. If we have learned anything from the 2024 election, it's how important it is for us to fight. We also learned how desperately the left wants to fight to take babies' lives, which is why every day Preborn Ministries fights for the babies. Preborn's network of clinics are positioned in the highest abortion areas, fighting for mothers deciding between the life and death of their child. Preborn welcomes these women with God's love and offers them a free ultrasound to introduce their precious baby and hear the beautiful heartbeat. This amazing encounter gives her baby a fighting chance, and the majority of the time, she will choose life. So would you join Preborn in the fight for life? One ultrasound is just $28, and $140 will sponsor 5 ultrasounds. Babies are worth fighting for. To donate, dial #250 on your cell phone and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby. Or you can visit preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR. All gifts are tax deductible, and Preborn has a 4-star charity rating. Fight for the babies.
Speaking truth with love. This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back. And for regular listeners, you know that we've been talking about the technology advances, specifically with AI, and Vice President J.D. Vance talking at the Paris AI Summit, and the digital bill of rights that came actually from Trump very early on in his campaign, and how all of this new technology is really being seen, at least in the forward-facing elements of the Trump administration, as, you know, really good. We need to give this to consumers. We need to advance all of this technology. But are there really reasonable guardrails, particularly in the realm of children's safety? Well, the Senate Judiciary Committee on Wednesday, had a full committee hearing on children's safety in the digital era, strengthening protections and addressing legal gaps. So joining me now to discuss what went on in the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing and where we should focus in terms of policy is Robert Winterton, who is the Vice President of Public Affairs for NetChoice. So, Robert, thanks so much for joining me. And where are we at with this whole conversation more broadly first?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me, Jenna. So in the broader conversation, I think Congress and a lot of lawmakers around the country have been looking into this important issue of how to keep children around our country safe online. It's obviously a very important conversation. It's one we at NetChoice really value as well, and we're happy that lawmakers are continuing to look into this. I think right now we tend to find that a lot of the conversation is very focused on holding tech platforms accountable for perhaps what we see as fundamental issues caused by criminals online. And there are a lot of predation, a lot of bad actors on there. And what I'm hoping to see from this Congress is some willingness to look also at, you know, law enforcement solutions, making sure that we are focusing on bad actors, going after those that predate minors online, and, you know, not just finding ways to delete their tweets or delete their posts, but actually ensuring that they get locked up for what they're doing.
Yeah, and I think that that's kind of a reasonable expectation here. And so when we're talking about, you know, children's safety in the digital era, it's not just about new technology. It's also about enforcement mechanisms for what we already have had in terms of the internet for a really long time. I mean, you know, for decades now. So where was the Senate Judiciary Committee and, you know, what came about in terms of holding this hearing now and what was discussed?
Yeah, so in terms of holding it now, I think that this Congress is trying to show that it has similar goals to the previous Congress and Congresses before when it comes to working on this issue. This is, as you might imagine, is not necessarily a new issue. Being concerned about the safety of minors online has been something that has come up many times over the years for all sorts of different reasons. So I think this is partially about level setting and starting that conversation within Congress. You know, in the hearing yesterday, I think we really saw a lot of focus on the areas where some lawmakers think that the tech industry needs to have policies changed to it that we at NetChoice might have some concerns with. And as a result, we think that hopefully this conversation can continue and move in a more collaborative direction, fundamentally looking at those law enforcement mechanisms rather than maybe, you know, different actors pointing the finger about why there might be inappropriate content online. Or, you know, those sorts of things are a little bit more subjective and harder to really coalesce around rather than focusing on specific bad actors, specific issues of predation, and making sure that we're being solutions oriented.
Yeah, and solutions oriented really makes sense. And of course, this needs, it, in my view, you know, that's where the funding really should be going. And so as we're looking at where DOGE is going with a lot of this and scaling back a lot of the excess spending, is there maybe an opportunity here to address some of these concerns about some of the cyber tips that don't go in with investigations just due to limited resources? I mean, I would think that this would be a nonpartisan issue that obviously spending resources to investigate this kind of issue would be a priority.
Yeah, I mean, as you point out, there's been, I think, a misallocation of priorities and resources within the federal government in all sorts of ways. You know, and the federal government at times has even been weaponized, as I think Representative Jim Jordan has been pointing out on the Weaponization of Government Committee in the House. And so I think this presents a really good opportunity, as you raised, to think, OK, well, what should different government agencies be doing? What should, for example, the FBI be doing? When we give them the money that we do, what should we be expecting and asking them to do with it? And you know, the issue of cyber tips is a really great example here. So, you know, all sorts of cyber tips and a huge amount of cyber tips are given to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children every year by the tech industry. They package them together and send them to the FBI for them to investigate. But more than 99% of cyber tips that are submitted there go without investigation because they don't have these resources. But I think that that's fundamentally something that we can all really agree that the FBI should be working on, right? Like domestic child predation issues, I'm sure is, you know, frankly, something that no one would really disagree with the federal government taking a greater role on. So as we go through this process that we're seeing with the DOGE committee and everything going on new under the Trump administration, rehoning our objectives of and what the federal government's doing, I think this is just a really prime example, right, of something we could all get behind.
Yeah, absolutely. And so is there discussion from at least the Trump administration side of these types of priorities when, you know, we're looking at what came about with the Digital Bill of Rights and some of these things, but now more into the child protection elements of all of this?
Yeah, I think the Trump administration is obviously working really hard in a bunch of different areas. And I think on this issue, they are still working out exactly what tack to take and how to best proceed. And that's why we're really keen to make this argument and to bring up, you know, the various things that we've discussed here with you to them, because, you know, I really think that this fits into a lot of the goals that the Trump administration has in terms of really trying to get away from previous ways of doing things. You know, a lot of this conversation about keeping minors safe online, I think, has been at times combative or more focused on penalizing different actors rather than us all coming together and all working in the same direction to go after bad actors, to go after those that are really going after and predating on children online. You know, this could be an issue of child sexual exploitation, could be an issue of exploiting their social security numbers. Minors are uniquely vulnerable to that issue, interestingly. And this is all stuff that we can agree on. And I think as the Trump administration seeks to get away from, you know, the discussion over child welfare, where there's not necessarily been a lot of coming around the table to really work out a solution that works for all the stakeholders, I think that really is a possibility now.
Yeah, and I would love to see the Trump administration get behind all of this in a very vocal fashion. And I'm speaking with Robert Winterton, who's the Vice President of Public Affairs for NetChoice. And this whole issue of children's safety obviously isn't a new one. And so did we hear anything that was particularly new or maybe more timely, considering that we're now a month in to the Trump administration from the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing yesterday?
Yeah, not in regards to, I think, the way that the Trump administration is really going about this. Congress is still very much, runs by the norms and the kind of ways of processing that it has done traditionally. And a big part of setting up these conversations and debates is to really lay the table with, you know, what's been discussed before, bring in some witnesses and see what you can learn. And I think that we did see kind of a repeated exercise here, rather than breaking new ground on new solutions and real ways to collaborate on such an important issue. And that's where I think the Trump administration, it would do great work to lay out, I think, a proactive idea of how public and private sector can work hand in hand to go after really some of the worst horrors in society when we're talking about online harms. I really do think that that's something we could do.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's also a component of, as you mentioned, more education just for parents as well. And I think that with the rise of technology and so many different things, it's really difficult sometimes for parents, especially if they're not used to the technology themselves, or even grandparents maybe, to understand kind of where the limitations are or where perhaps the security risks are. Is there an opportunity for perhaps some of these resources being devoted to parental education?
Yeah, absolutely. Parental education, I think, is a real cornerstone of NetChoice's vision for what the government can be doing to really help on this issue. We saw a really useful law passed in Virginia that established basically digital literacy as part of the state curriculum when it comes to educating children and families about how to use these tools. Because at the end of the day, you know, a lot of these tools are available. The settings are there. People just lack the confidence and the know-how to be able to navigate them. And so if we can bridge that gap and really provide those resources, I think we're going to see a lot of, people just taking it upon themselves and parents just being active and proactive here at keeping their children safe online, because they can do things like limit who's getting in contact with their children on various apps, what apps they're even able to download in the first place. You know, there's a real sliding scale of how locked down you want a device to be, where, most basically any to be able to do anything requires parental approval, over to something that you might give, an older teenager or something, where there's far fewer restrictions and it's really more of a light touch situation. So allowing families and empowering them to make the decisions that work best for them is, again, one of those solutions that I just think it's really hard to argue against.
Absolutely. I mean, and again, this should be a nonpartisan issue. This should be something that everybody agrees that we should be keeping children safe. And that should be in the context of any sort of digital age technology, to just the right to intact bodies. I mean, all of these conversations, I think, are kind of should be from the same nonpartisan standpoint. But I really appreciate your commentary, Robert Winterton, on this really important topic. And in just the last few seconds we have here, what resources does NetChoice offer that maybe parents who are listening can go and benefit from?
Yeah, absolutely. You can come to our website at netchoice.org or our X account, which has the same name. And there we offer a lot of resources about the political and policy discussions here. There's a lot of resources out there that we link to this issue, such as part of NetChoice's SHIELD proposal, that also are helpful for parents looking to work out the different tools out there and how they can best protect their kids online.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for the work that you're doing. And as always, listeners, you can reach me and my team at Jenna at AFR.net. Have a great weekend. We'd like to thank our sponsors, including Preborn. Preborn has rescued over 200,000 babies from abortion, and every day their network clinics rescue 200 babies' lives. Will you join Preborn in loving and supporting young moms in crisis? Save a life today. Go to preborn.com.